Hey friends, it is Community Day here at the .NET Conf, our virtual conference. We're having so much fun learning about all sorts of great stuff from members of the community. Beam straight to you from Channel 9. Finally today, last but not least, my friend James Chambers. He's an MVP, and you can find him on Channel 9 under ASP.NET Monsters. And he is going to come and talk about the humanitarian toolbox and building a thing called Already. So we're literally saving lives with ASP.NET Core. Take it away, James.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Scott. And thanks, everyone. I know it's been 3 days of presentations and we're closing it out here, but hopefully we close it out strong, pique your interest in the project, and share a little bit about what we're doing to make, you know, to have technology influence some real world things out in the charity, and in particular in the disaster preparedness and humanitarian response kind of space. So we're going to talk about this project called Already, and it's got a bit of an origin story, just like all superheroes. And so we're going to talk about that. We're going to take a break to walk through a couple of slides that just kind of demonstrate what the program looks like when it's running. It's an app that runs. It's a web application that runs, and there's a mobile app that pairs with it. We've got some really exciting opportunities. This is not just a vaporware project or something that's sitting on a shelf, and I've got some pretty cool announcements about how the software is going to be used in the very short term here. And so we'll talk through some of that and why folks like myself are volunteering our hours in order to make this project happen. It, even though it's a different kind of open source project, it is an open source project and we write code. So we will have a look at what I think are some of the more interesting bits that we get to twiddle. And then we're going to talk about the upcoming code-a-thons and how we have had so far the community step up to make the project a success, and of course how you can get involved if you want to join in. So I'll get right into it, and we'll start talking about this organization called the Humanitarian Toolbox. Now, this is a registered charity in the United States. It's the brainchild of some really great folks like Tony Surma and Bill Wagner, and of course Richard Campbell, who is of course the .NET Rocks fame. When I first, the first MVP summit that I went to was in 2012 in Redmond, and I met Richard Campbell for the first time in person, and I stopped by the table where he actually had this project set up, and the idea, the premise was that the next disaster was going to be one that could either be alleviated by technology or prevented by technology. And through doing the roadshow that they did several times in a row and talking with developers, talking with charities, getting all of these people together who wanted to do something more than just the fly-by coding kind of thing, Richard kind of started talking about coding for the greater good. And this is a really interesting concept because it allows a software developer to use the skill set that they're good at to apply it to solving problems in the real world. And we're going to come back and talk about that. I've got some great examples about how we can kind of think about how this project is a little bit different. So here we go. There's this story starting. Richard's out there exploring with other founding members of HTBox, trying to figure out how to start to connect some of these pieces, seeing some of the gaps that are out there, and trying to identify and overcome some of the roadblocks that were out there. The first one that was kind of common from project to project out in the space of charities and humanitarian organizations was that they were perpetually fighting what we call dead code syndrome. So this isn't bad code. This isn't software that could not ever or did not ever help organizations. But what happens typically is in the event of an emergency or some kind of response to a disaster, software developers are super giving, just like so many other people in other professions. They hurry in, they write code to help solve the problem, to get notifications up and running, to do a crisis check-in type software that uses really, really low bandwidth on cell networks, these kinds of things. But And there's this other kind of style of software development that happens where we get together for, you know, one day code-a-thons, and we build a piece of software or a website or some kind of utility for a charity. But through this whole process and how these things come together, we're actually inviting each other as software developers to be transient and to not really commit, because we can say you can come in and one day and make a difference, but at the end of that code-a-thon and a week after the event, there's a pile of source code that this charity or organization has no idea what to do with. Sometimes they've got an exe, they don't have the original source code, they can't even maintain things. And so this was a real problem that exists today and still exists, not to mention the fact that we could also call, you know, there's this kind of idea of zombie code, and it's kind of multiplying, and we keep putting effort into it again and again and again. I do a lot of work with an organization called the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. My oldest son was diagnosed when he was 4 years old, and they have a walk every year. And so every year the volunteers get together and we promote the walk, and we've got software that works online that collects donations for the walk. Now, this is great. The problem is that most charities are putting together software like this, and they're spending effort or dollars or whatever the case may be in order to stand up these sites where they can collect donations. And so the question then becomes, is this a bit of a conflict? Charities are stood up with a mission statement for finding a cure for a disease, for providing shelter for the homeless, or meals on the table for families at certain times of the year. And when they're spending money on software to help manage the organization, are they actually serving their mission statement? It's a means to an end, and it's a good one. It's a good end. But sometimes that means might mean that they are spending dollars or effort in a way that may not accurately represent the intentions of those who have donated to the charity. So this is a huge challenge when it comes to technology. And it's not just in software, but software is certainly a place where this can end up being a pain point. For myself, you know, that when I was invited to participate in the project at the last MVP summit, I looked at this in this kind of opened my eyes as to how I could start to give my time in a way that was meaningful with the skill set I have. The example that I like to give is simply that when, you know, during the day, my profession, my expertise is built on a tool stack that includes PowerShell and C# and Visual Studio and VS Code and GitHub and Git and these types of things. And for me to previously give of my time, it meant putting down these tools of which I have some level of mastery over, and for example, going and helping an organization that helps build homes for families that otherwise wouldn't be able to get a mortgage and put themselves into shelter. Now, this is a perfectly good model, and we need to have these things. We need to provide shelter and whatnot. But when you take a software developer and give him a skill saw, we typically don't have enough bandages on site to take care of that problem. So this, for me, was an eye-opener, and the project and the idea behind the Humanitarian Toolbox is really to let software developers contribute in a meaningful way to solve problems for the world. Now, the project already itself, this was actually born from Dimitri, who works on the technical product team. He's a technical product manager, was working really close with the team that brought us the latest version of Visual Studio 2015. And he kind of surveyed the land, and he looked around and said, you know, we keep building these Contoso apps, and we keep building these Fabricam APIs. Let's not do that anymore. Let's actually do something that matters. And there was kind of a perfect storm. Richard Campbell and the crew at HTBox were kind of coming together. There were connections through Tony Surma that tied into the American Red Cross, where Jim McGowan is one of the regional managers with the American Red Cross based out of Chicago. And all of these people who kind of saw a problem and an opportunity and some skills that could, you know, come together and make this happen, this perfect storm came to light and already was born. So it was actually donated by Microsoft and staffers who contributed time not only during the workday, but then into the evenings and into the weekends, and made the first version of Already possible. And that was then made available on at the launch of Visual Studio 2015, launched as an open source project in synchronicity with the release of Visual Studio 2015. After that, it started to pick up a little bit of momentum. There was a conference in Wisconsin Dells called That Conference, and at That Conference, which is actually the name, I'm not saying That Conference, it's like That Conference, that's the name of it. Anyways, at That Conference, there was a code-a-thon that lasted a full day there, and we actually started getting developers who were committed. And from that first conference where the code-a-thon took place, we got volunteers who are today still contributing on a regular basis to the project. And that started a seed, that planted a seed. And then it kind of spiraled. And from there, we had a three-day hackathon in Bellevue. I should say code-a-thon, not hackathon, a code-a-thon in Bellevue after the MVP summit. And we had 20 MVPs with all areas of expertise. If it's CI or CD, folks who work in Azure, folks who are on the front end, on the back end, doing testing, whatever the case may be, we had over 20 people in the facility there, and we were able to start to just do this massive amount of work and put together some really good solutions to things. So it was really exciting to see all of those things happen. And we're going to talk a lot more about the code-a-thons because that's a really important part of this project. And it's something that's setting this project apart, I think, or we think at HTBox insofar as how people are approaching it. So we're going to talk about the code-a-thons. But first, I want to break really quickly and talk about Already, what this application actually is. So it's a focus on solving a problem where Already, as the name suggests, is about preparedness. It's about having all of the things ready in the event that disaster strikes. Now, this can be anything. This could be an earthquake or some kind of evacuation. This can be, what we're doing with the American Red Cross has to do with smoke alarms and being prepared for a house fire. So what are the things that you need to do to be ready in the event of an emergency? It's an odd place to kind of position yourself because as far as news goes, we tend to have the more sensational news coverage when we see the firefighter walking out of the house saving a child. The problem is that we don't ever want to have the firefighter walk into the house. And so we want to be prepared for these types of things. So here's the basic idea. Now we're going to step back again before we talk about the campaign that the Red Cross is running in particular. We're going to talk about how most organizations work. Most organizations that are in the humanitarian space or in the disaster preparedness space will run a campaign. It will be for awareness. It will be for fundraising. It will be to solicit time from volunteers. Okay, these campaigns typically run over the course of some kind of funding period, typically annually, perhaps quarterly. So these campaigns run, and every campaign will have one or more events. The events could be going to a certain place and time over the course of a couple of days and having people sign up, having people lend their talent, those kinds of things. Every event will have multiple tasks. There's people who need to set up for an event. There's people who need to tear down. There's people who need to execute. So far, these are fairly normal things. Each task will need one or more volunteers. At the onset, when you first start to examine the problem, it actually seems like it's pretty easy to solve. The problem is one of scale. So when you've got an organization the size of the American Red Cross, you will have typically a campaign that runs, for example, in 50 states, and every state will have multiple locations, and each of those will run multiple events. And when every event has two or three tasks, and every task has two or three volunteers, you start to get up into 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 volunteer hours that you now need to coordinate. Now, remember, these are nonprofit organizations. These are people who have limited capacity to execute. And when you want to do something big, you want to be as efficient as possible. Now we're talking about 5,000, 10,000 hours of volunteers' time, and you need to make that come together. And then that is further complicated by the fact that things change. So you might have a rained out venue and you're no longer able to come. You need a way to message those volunteers. So now all of a sudden there's a notification framework that needs to be built out. It's no longer a simple data model. Maybe you're dealing with other things. For example, the area to which you are dispatching volunteers does not have internet access. So you need to rely on something like SMS messaging in order to communicate with your volunteers and have it done in an automated way so that they don't have to get on the phone and make phone calls. For most of the things that are going to happen, they're going to be, you know, I was able to complete this task, or we need more resources to complete this task, things like that. But we don't have to actually interact with a human in order to make that happen. We can do this via APIs and scripts that run on the back end of SMS messaging. Sometimes volunteers are simply unavailable. They've got their own crisis to deal with. They've got a family emergency or they've become ill and they're unable to complete a task. We need to notify the other volunteers. We need to reschedule things. And so now we're starting to talk about placing volunteers on an itinerary to complete a set of tasks or complete a set of requests as part of their job for that day and understanding when those tasks cannot be completed. So right away, you know, there's those kind of obvious things. When we want to start to refine the ability to assign volunteers to tasks or events, then we also want to get into skill set matching. We're going to install a smoke alarm. Well, we want someone who's a qualified electrician. If we're going to do an awareness campaign, we need educators who have been trained properly and have that skill set in their portfolio. So now we start to get into some really, I mean, it seems like a simple problem, but we've got some really interesting computer science-y type things that we can start to do inside of a project like this. Let's have a look at what it looks like. So I'm going to just walk through a couple of the screens. If you do want to check this out, we'll make sure that we put a link, but the development branch is automatically built and deployed. So you can go to already-d.azurewebsites.net and you can see this thing running for yourself. Interact with the same screens that I'm showing here. So when we come to the dashboard or the main screen for Already, and keep in mind this is a work in progress. We'll talk about some of the design needs on the project. It's very listy. It looks like software developers designed it. That's largely true. But we have a list of upcoming campaigns. So as a volunteer, I can walk up to the site. I can see what things are happening in my area. Another interesting problem, we start talking about geolocation. So now we've got maps and things like that. With the campaign selected, a volunteer can either, you know, you can go in and see all of the campaigns that are there, or you can drill into one and you can find out how you can participate in one of the tasks on an event for a campaign. And in this particular case, I'm looking at something. I can see the location at it, where it's going to happen. I can see how many volunteers are needed and what skill sets are required in order for them to properly execute those tasks. Volunteers, administrators actually are, they have these other tasks too that they need to do. So somebody who's an administrator for an organization would come in. They would be the ones who are creating these campaigns. They would be creating the events and creating tasks that require certain skill sets. So all of these things come together as well inside of the application, and all of those are defined as part of this app as well. And then, of course, you know, we have to be able to manage the events and the tasks. And as an administrator, and actually, I'm just going to go back there really quickly, we can even monitor the progress. So we can say, you know, we wanted to make sure that in the 520 neighborhoods that were identified, that we want to know how many of those have been completed. In this case, 480 inside the sample data, 480 out of 520 of these tasks have been executed. So this is a wonderful way to be able to track and kind of, you know, get that thermometer kind of idea, that single point of view that tells you how well you're doing on a campaign. As an administrator, I have the ability to add additional organizations to the website and promote people to roles so that they can be part of an organization role that allows them to administer campaigns, tasks, event, volunteer assignments all on their own. But the really cool thing about this is that this is also an open source project, and it's free for any organization to use. And I'm going to be talking again about the American Red Cross today, but really any organization that runs a campaign that has one or more events with one or more tasks on it that needs one or more volunteers, this is kind of an application that can help them in that sense. And they will not have to pay for, they will not have to curate the code. And that's really the beauty of how the Humanitarian Toolbox collects those concerns and then makes the software available for charities. So that's one of the reasons why I'm really geeked to be joining the Already Project and helping out and seeing it. Now you can see here, just this was from a couple of days ago already, but we've got over 1,500 commits. There are over 50 contributors and over 200 forks on this. And really, this really just kicked up last August in earnest at that conference. So you can see in just a short period of time, we are getting people from all over the world contributing, and that is really, really exciting. As well, it's, you know, while it's primarily a C# project, there's a lot of code written in C#. We also have JavaScript. It is an application that runs in the browser. So we've got some JavaScript. We're doing some things like Knockout and whatnot in there. We've got CSS that's in there, HTML, of course. Some of our functional tests are some of our tests that examine the behavior of the application in our test environment. Those are actually done in F#. We've got batch files for our build process to keep our pipeline running and help with deployment, things like that. And we've got some TypeScript, which is actually how we generate a lot of the front-end JavaScript that goes into the project. So it's a fun tech stack. We're going to look at that in a little bit more in greater detail in a few minutes here. I want to talk about where we're going, but first I think that we got to back up a little bit and talk about where we've been. And to kind of put some of this stuff in context, the American Red Cross, the number just astounds me, but the American Red Cross, or actually the Red Cross in North America, every 8 minutes deals with some kind of emergency where they go and they dispatch volunteers and they go and help respond to a crisis of some kind. Closer to home here in Canada, we just had over 80,000 people evacuated from Fort McMurray with a wildfire that came in and burnt down over 1,800 structures inside a town in northern Alberta. So, you know, this is something where a large number of people are required in order to make this happen. And they go out into perilous conditions all months, all seasons of the year, at any time of the day. Doesn't matter if it's 2 in the afternoon or 2 in the morning, they're going to be there. Anytime there's a house fire in North America, the American Red Cross will be there with blankets and teddy bears and providing counseling for the family that's in need. Two real examples of how this program is really starting to help and really starting to make a difference. In 2015, the campaign running for smoke alarms to be installed by the Red Cross hit a whole plethora of homes across the nation. April 13th, 2016, fast forward to just over a month ago, and a volunteer firefighter out of Sumas, Washington, actually was alerted to a fire in his home through a smoke alarm that was in his house, installed by the American Red Cross as part of the campaign to get smoke alarms in every home. And he was able to evacuate the premise. He was no longer in danger's way, called 911. Everybody made it out alive. And then just a few weeks ago, a grandmother in Columbus, Indiana, had her grandson visiting. Apparently he had put something on the stove, didn't communicate that well. He left an hour later or something of the sort. There was a cooking kind of kerfuffle, and it engulfed the kitchen in flames. Again, a smoke alarm that was installed by this program, was this campaign from the Red Cross, was alerted the grandmother. She made it out safely, was able to call 911, and no one was hurt. We don't typically hear about those ones as much because they're not as great imagery as those, you know, live crisis moments. They don't make for as good as TV, but this is the reason why people step up across this country to do these types of things. And so that's something that's really, really excited. Ahead of us, we have the American Red Cross has got a donation of 10,000 smoke alarms from Lowe's. And so we've got this pilot project that's kicking off with the Red Cross. And there, we're now currently working with teams in Seattle and Chicago to provide the coordination of volunteers through Allready with live projects, live testing in the field. This is for real, and the code will be used in production. So we're reaching a really exciting time. Less than a year after concept, this thing is now in production using only volunteer hours. So this is just a huge thing, and we're super geeked about it. The other thing that we're doing is, as part of those initiatives to get the smoke alarms in to those homes, there's a project that's kind of up and going. It's called getasmokealarm.org. It's presented by the American Red Cross. And we are actually providing an integration API that talks back and forth so that people who request a smoke alarm will actually have their request sent into the Allready software, which will then associate them with an event that's upcoming. And they'll eventually, that request will eventually be serviced by volunteers that are coordinated by Allready. As that request is progressed, as the smoke alarm is installed, we signal back via another API to getasmokealarm.org, and we let them know the progress along the way. So there's valuable statistics there for charities. There is information provided to the person who's requesting the smoke alarm to know when they're going to have that alarm installed. And then there's all kinds of other things that we can do, like sending the text notifications to remind the homeowner that somebody's going to be coming by tomorrow to install a smoke alarm, and really increase the chance of success in executing one of these events. We recently heard a number that there's somewhere close to a success rate of under 25% when we're trying to do things like execute on time-based scheduled tasks inside charities in North America, less than 1 in 4. So to improve that at all, we're going to see more instances like those that volunteer firefighter and like that grandmother who made it out alive. And that's going to be because we've increased the communication that we've got with not only the volunteers, but also the homeowners and the people that are requesting things. So really exciting stuff that's on the go. But I did promise that this is software and we do have source code, and I want to have a look at what this project actually looks like. But before we do that, I just want to, a quick disclaimer, we're going to have a look at the tech stack, but I do want to say that, you know, with 1500 commits on a growing application, you know, I'll pop over to Visual Studio really quickly for you so you can see this, but there's already a significant amount of code, and there's a lot of noise in here. I wanted to isolate a few things and kind of demonstrate it. In the project itself, we've got some DLLs that are used across projects. So we've broken that out. There's some tests in here, our scenario tests, which I do not have F# installed on this metal, so that is something that's required to run the scenario tests. But we've got a whole suite of unit tests. I have been absolutely floored by the way the community has stepped up. We've got a couple contributors in particular who have just jumped right in and helped improve the coverage and really improve the code base because they've exposed bugs and defects. And while they're noodling around trying to find areas where they can add tests, they're finding problems with the software and they're solving those things before they ever get under prod. It's been a completely invaluable contribution, and we see that happen again and again. Beyond the tests, we've got the web project itself. This is an ASP.NET Core MVC project, and you can see here it looks pretty much like a standard thing. We've got some extra pieces in here, some features folders and things like that, some security folders. I'll talk about that in a minute when we dive into the code. But structure-wise, if you have built an MVC project before, you should be able to go in and find the things that you would know about. We've got the areas folder and controllers. There's things like migrations in here that you're probably familiar with. We've got view models and views, and then, you know, each view is separated as it would be inside an MVC project. So all of those common things are there. And then finally, we've got a notifications processor, which is executed as a web job when deployed to Azure. And that is something that allows us to take the load off of the server and keep the website moving quickly when, again, we're fast forwarding and we're thinking about potentially 10,000 volunteers on one day interacting with the site. We want to make sure this thing is clipping along and not waiting for an SMS message to send. So we toss that over and over the fence, and we let web jobs pick that up. We'll have a look at how that happens too in just a couple of minutes. So the tech stack, already said, we've got Visual Studio 2015. Of course, it's built on ASP.NET Core MVC. I'm going to kind of walk through this one. I want to talk about some of these points in particular. We're using sites. So we're using, just the standing up a scalable site inside of Azure Web Apps. And we've also deployed the jobs, the web jobs aspect of it. And as I said, that allows us to take care of things like notifications and long running pieces that really probably don't belong on the request pipeline over to serve the website for the users of the application. We also lean on Azure Storage. That's how we do our messaging. So we've got tables and queues in place there. I believe we're actually even using the storage for serialize images so that images that are uploaded for campaigns, those are going to be saved out into Azure Storage as well. MVC, or rather ASP.NET Core, actually has a wonderful, simple, meets most needs IOC container. We had a couple of dependencies that kind of needed a little bit more help, so we've brought in AutoFAC. One of those was Mediator. We're using that to send messages out of the controller, keep our controller simple, and I've got some really great examples of how that happened, so I'll show you that as well. We've got Entity Framework 7, so if you're interested in playing with what EF7 looks like, this is one where we've actually got some really great experts on the team. So we like to call Dave Paquette the Julie Lerman of Canada. He's based out of Calgary, Alberta, and he's our resident EF expert, and we bring him in to whenever we've got a problem with anything to do with Entity Framework. We're also using GitHub, as you've seen already, as our store for source control. We're using AppVare, and we're also using the GitHub Status API. This has really alleviated a lot of the load on the on us as the curators of the code. So there's a few of us, Bill Wegner, Tony Serma, and myself are doing managing the pull requests and merging those in. And by using AppVare, GitHub, and the GitHub Status API, it's allowed us to do the pre-build checks. So the pull request will actually go green. We've got a required status check. You cannot merge it back into master until that pull request goes green. And so that's a wonderful kind of piece for us to have on the project. It's really facilitated things. Any other open source developers that are out there, I highly encourage using the GitHub Status API. It's a wonderful way to make sure that your pull requests are solid. It prevents you from having to pull down that branch or that pull request locally and exercising the tests on your own. We've also got SendGrid and Twilio that's used for messaging, and we've taken a dependency on XUnit for our testing purposes. So I am super geeked about this stack. I love the opportunity to work with the new bits. We are currently on ASP.NET Core MVC. We are targeting DNX451. We're still on RC1 with what we're trying to do going to prod. I mean, we are actually this Saturday in Seattle on the date is the 11th. In Seattle, we are live in prod. So rather than destabilizing, we've only got so many volunteer hours, we are focused on delivering features for this Saturday. So RTM is out later this month for Core MVC. We're waiting till RTM. We'll do the upgrade at that point and we'll be on the latest and greatest. As well, we're hoping our goal and our intent is to move to Core and to be running on .NET proper, not on one of the ones that pulls in the .NET framework, not on one of those configurations. And the reason for that is just simply so that anyone on any operating system would be able to pull down the source code and contribute regardless of their editor, their choice of editor, and those types of things. We've got areas of the application right now that can be edited on any platform or whatever, but to stand the application up and run it locally, you need to have a Windows operating system at this time. So we're moving towards that. As our third-party dependencies move to Core and those get completed, we're going to have a more and more of an application that is ready to be running on Core exclusively. So as I said, it's built on Core MVC. So we're using some of the new things. I'm actually a really big fan of the new configuration model. So if you ever run into me and I'm talking about MVC, it's probably going to be, I'm actually speaking at a conference next week. We're talking about how easy configuration has become. And you can do something just like add user secrets, and any of the local developer secrets are going to be added to your project. So it's a really easy way to configure things. We're using this heavily in our system, some of these new features that you see in startup.cs when you launch a new application. as well. You can see how we pull that in, and we can start to use, you know, we're using Entity Framework. Right away, the configuration options come into play. This is kind of a thing that might throw you for a loop at first. The first time you look at it, there's this key that we're using. So my configuration has already loaded. I'm at the point in startup.cs where my configuration has already loaded. Let me just control MO this to collapse the code. So I've got the startup, I've got configuration, I've got configure services, I've got create IOC container. This configuration is just a property that's exposed here in startup.cs and used throughout. So in the startup process, we actually build out any of the configuration that we've added to the application through, for example, particular JSON files, the config that we've got using. We've got a JSON file that could be per environment. We bring in the environment variables. Finally, if it's in development, in the development environment running locally, we add the user secrets, add some telemetry if we want to. You can enable that and play with that out in Azure if you want to. And then we build the configuration, and we store that in this iConfiguration right here. From that point forward, when we're actually configuring things, we've got the ability just to call on that. So I'll go back to the slide. It's a little bit of an easier view. We've got add entity framework here. We're doing add SQL Server, and we've got add DB context. We specify the name of our context. And then we've got this Lambda here, which exposes our options property. We're going to use SQL Server using the connection string. So where did that come from? That's back up here. We've got a key called data default connection string, and that was loaded into this dictionary that we've got, just a key value pair. And if I go back into my code, I can see here we've got this config JSON, which is in the root of the application. So in our web folder, we've got the already project, and there's this config.json. And inside there, we've got all of the settings. I find the data default connection string, and this structure is represented when it's loaded into that key value store for configuration. It actually has this information is, you know, this key is built out by that structure. Okay, so we can have structured data, but and it'll deserialize into a simple container for us that we can access by key. There's another really cool thing that we can do with that, though. One of them is if we were to create an object called Azure Storage Settings. So this is just a POCO object that we've got in here. And we're going to tell the services to configure itself with an instance of Azure Storage Settings, and we're going to load it from configuration.getSection. So rather than getting a single key, we're going to load this section of the configuration information that we've got, all keys below it, and we're going to put it into this Azure Storage Settings object. What I'm talking about here is I've got data storage, and I've got a couple of properties, a storage key that's used to write to the Azure storage space, the service out on the cloud, or I've got a flag that actually enables the queue service, and this allows for local debugging without having to use the storage emulators. So I can now run the application, and instead of going to the queue, what we actually do is we kind of just dump to the debug log, so that allows you to kind of see what's going on without having to have that local storage emulator installed. But we've got this storage section, data storage. We've got these properties called Azure Storage and Enable Queue Storage. And when I'm looking at this code again, I'm actually pulling that data storage out, stuffing it into this Azure Storage Settings object, and then we make it available to our entire application. What's really cool is what happens next, because now it's part of IOC, and my dependency injection container actually understands what an Azure Storage Settings object is. So I can inject an iOptions of type Azure Storage Settings as an options object into my queue storage service. And then what I can do is I can say the connection string for that is in options.value, where value is an instantiated copy of this object, this queue storage service.
Hey, James?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Hey, we lost your video. Could you turn your video on and off again?
So now we've got an instance of this Azure Storage Settings that's available inside of the queue storage, and I can actually pull that out. Value is an instantiated copy of this object, the Azure Storage Settings object that has the properties loaded in from our config.json. So we've pulled that out, we've got it in the options, and it's stored in this value. So now I can get that key, I put that connection string, parse that out with the cloud storage account object, and I actually get an instance of the client that I can create from the storage account.create cloud queue client. So that's Azure-y things. I'm not going to dive into that too much, but that one, I just wanted to really express that this new options pattern is something that we're using, and I'm super geeked about because it gives us strongly typed configuration that is structured. So it's configuration that's not just a whole bunch of add key value equals, add, you know, under inside of our app settings or whatever. We've actually got some meaningful way to structure our data. So that's kind of a cool thing. Mediator, right. So we found as we were building the application up that our dependencies started to grow on our controllers. And one of the patterns, this is a, you know, a design pattern called Mediator. What we do, or we actually use this library called Mediator with an R because that's how cool kids name their libraries. And we've got this, you can see the signature for my event controller knows nothing about a repository or the data context or notification services or anything like that. And what it does is it means that my controller no longer has to worry about any of the business logic. It can just say, hey, this thing happened, or I need this data and I don't want to worry about how I need to go about getting that data. Just give it to Mediator, let it resolve the request, and it will execute that work, preferably asynchronously, because we've got that ability in modern web applications. It's going to go off and do that work, come back, and then give me the data. So I've got Mediator here in my class. It's instantiated with a field level variable. And inside of my action result, or my create method, async task I action result, I pass in a campaign ID that creates a new campaign query summary, sets that property, sends it through Mediator asynchronously, and the result that comes back is the campaign. So when I'm creating, I'm on the event controller. When I'm creating a new event, I go and load up the campaign and find the details. You know, we want to do things like make sure the dates are within bounds and things like that. I don't need to worry about that inside of my controller. The business logic can be expressed using commands and queries inside of the project. So a really great way to get you know, your controllers simplified and to isolate your business logic, make things super easy to test. This has been a godsend, literally, in making the project easier to understand, really lowering the bar for having to understand all of the moving parts in the application when new people have come on board. If you are getting started, have a look at that config.json. If you want to fully experience the app running locally, you're going to want to do things like set up Facebook, Twitter, SendGrid, Twilio, those types of things, your Azure storage account. And one thing that I do want to point out, right at the top, we say right here, do not put sensitive information into the config.json. Use this for awareness. I'm not going to name any names, Steve Gordon, but somebody did have a breach putting their Facebook credentials in here. So we had to take care of that. We do try our best to review those things, but please make sure that you don't put your sensitive information. And we've got a link here to ASP.NET secrets, our user secrets inside ASP.NET Core. This is a wonderful little way to have per project, per developer, kind of almost like, think of them like per developer, per project environment variables. That's kind of a neat way to think of them. Okay. I want to bring back to this community concept. We are now seeing pull requests every week. This is a couple days old, this slide again, but the contributions that we're getting every week has been amazing. And what was that, Scott? Oh, no, it's okay. That's all. Sure, no problem. So one of the really cool things that I've watched on this project is how other people are jumping in and helping each other out. So we've got people coming over with a TFS background and they're saying, I'd like to contribute, but I have no idea how to do this on GitHub. And we have actually got people stepping up, jumping on Skype with complete strangers and walking them through doing pull requests and understanding the code base. And one of the other things that's come of all of this is that we've got people like Steve Gordon and people like Dave Paquette who are writing intro guides, how to do your first pull request on GitHub on an open source project. And they've put together like whole blog posts that walk you through it, and they're featuring already. So it's in context for this project. There's some really great resources that are out there. We have these codeathons I talked about. We've done a number of them already. The most recent one we had was in Nebraska Code in Lincoln, Nebraska. So I was there with Richard Campbell a couple of weeks ago, and we got to meet some new developers that are just diving right in and contributing code. These actually happened globally. On February 20th, we had people writing code in the UK, in the Caribbean, in Canada, the United States, and Australia, literally like like 14 or 16 hours sequentially on February 20th, we had people working on this project from around the world. So it was a really cool day for us to see this spike in code and all these new contributors come in. That is continuing to happen. We see that every week. We see some new people. We want to make it as easy as possible. So if you want to host a Codeathon, we're building out this idea of the Codeathon in a box. Here's all of the things you need to get started. Here's the things to say, way to introduce the project, some demo data to get started, all of those things. And you can always get support from anyone on the HTBox team. We've often made appearances. We go and help out at Codeathons, at conferences and things like that across North America. And we are also more than happy to help to jump on Skype at any given time. If you've got the ability to rally some troops, that's cool too. So there's user groups that might be wanting to help. There's organizations that might be able to help. And because it's a registered charity, your company could actually get tax benefits for donating time. So you can use this as an opportunity to learn some new code and then get the benefit of being able to write it off while your developers are being trained. So I think it's a really win-win kind of thing that's coming up. We have leaders in all across the like all over here that are really stepping up. I want to point out a couple of them. Rocky Lodka in Minneapolis has held a couple of Codeathons for HTBox, doing some great things there. Simon Timms in Calgary, Alberta also jumped on. Simon's also one of the monsters on Channel 9. And Rob Richardson, who is just down in Nebraska, he's of AZ Give Camp, and he has just jumped in and started contributing code. And we've got him, I think, as a lifer now on the project. So that's wonderful. If you want to get connected, I'm going to try and go through this really quickly. Work from the backlog. There's, you know, we're closing in on 1,000 issues and pull requests. This has just been amazing to see this happen. There's issues that are being reported. There's ongoing field tests, things like that. And if you just explore the app, you'll find things that you may come across that you want to point out to us. We may not be aware of it. The community is free to create issues. We encourage you to do that. We also have a mobile application with the release of Xamarin and coming under the Microsoft toolchain. We're kind of wondering now, do we go to Xamarin? Do we stay with Cordova? Cordova leaves it open to developers who aren't familiar with C# development to build out the mobile application. So that's a conversation that we've got right now. We've got some tech debt that's in the system. We're trying to, you know, with different project leaders over the last year and with different origins for different intents, we of course have different approaches to solving problems throughout the code. We're trying to eliminate that complexity and make it really easy to get started. If you fork the project, if you install Visual Studio 2015, you fork the project, clone it locally, you can build and run the tests. Everything works. There's no special setup. You do not need to get all of those keys and the storage configuration and all that running. You can if you want to dive into some of the features, but you absolutely do not need to do that. You can pull this project down, build it, and start contributing. So that's really cool. And we totally ripped off the ASP.NET team. So we do stand-ups on Google Hangouts quasi-weekly. We're not every week, but if you follow HTBox on Twitter or follow the hashtag already, then we will definitely post on there and let you know when the stand-ups are happening. They're typically Saturday mornings, 10 a.m. Central. So that lets us hit a bunch of different time zones. And because we're all volunteers, having it on the weekend, you know, maybe you're able to carve out a little bit of time and tune in for that. We've got some great resources on the project site itself, lots of documentation. There's introductory videos. We've got whiteboard design sessions, all of those things. A couple of Codeathons that are coming up. That conference, Wisconsin Dells, August 8th to 10th. Grace Hopper in Houston, Texas, August 19th to 21. These are non-trivial conferences. There are thousands of people that are going to be there. If you're going to be there, we encourage you to sign up for the Codeathon and dive in. I'm going to put up my thank you slide. I know we're just slightly over time here, so I'm going to throw up my thank you slide. And if there are any questions, or Scott, if you had any questions for me, then I'd be happy to help out.
I think we're doing all right, and I think that it was better to have you do the time than it is to go over questions right now, and I thought that was great. And I think that it's significant because we're showing people in the community who aren't just doing open source, who aren't just doing their own projects, but are doing meaningful work that is really changing lives, very significant charitable work.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know, you have the opportunity when you kind of survey that open source landscape, there's a lot of opportunity to contribute to technical oriented projects. So we're just asking, you know, that folks consider looking in the humanitarian direction as well, and maybe do something that, you know, as Richard Campbell says, is coding for the greater good.
Very cool. And we can check you out at HTBox on Twitter, and that can really be the place to jump off to all the other resources.
Absolutely. That's right. Or HTBox.org if you want to hit it on online.
Very cool. All right. Well, we're all here at the, I'm going to put our camera back on for you can see us as well. But we're all here, and we want to thank you all for spending time with us here on Channel 9.
Absolutely.
Whether it be Jeff or Maria, Javier, hey. Seth and Golnaz back on the work in the booth and doing all of the hard work. Golnaz has been sitting there basically stuck at the booth, switching all the cameras and doing all the great hard work. Everyone's been very tireless, and we appreciate everyone who works. And you flew here.
I flew here, yeah. I flew here on Monday to get everything set up and going. So thank you very much for
Everyone who gives their time. You know, it's been kind of your baby for so long.
Yes, it
has. We appreciate your
effort. Year 4. It's like we're hoping to get renewed next year.
You think you'll get renewed for another season?
For another season.
And if it
season
doesn't
5.
Work out, yeah, maybe Netflix will pick us up.
You know, maybe. That's right. That'd
so
be great.
Cool. So thanks so much. From all of us here at Channel 9 and .NET Conf, we'll see you again next year.